This is VOA News. I'm Richard Green. Former U.S. President Donald Trump remains defiant after becoming the first former U.S. leader to be indicted on criminal charges. VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman has the story.
Addressing a crowd of supporters invited into his private Mar-a-Lago resort in the state of Florida, former President Donald Trump said he never thought anything like this could happen in America.
The only crime that I have committed is to fearlessly defend our nation from those who seek to destroy it.
Trump suggested the case was brought by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office to interfere with the 2024 presidential election. Polls show Trump comfortably leading all other declared and anticipated contenders for next year's Republican Party nomination. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
Trump made the remarks just hours after his New York City court appearance, where he pleaded not guilty to 34 felony charges stemming from hush money payments prosecutors allege were part of an unlawful scheme to influence the 2016 presidential election, which Trump won. In the first ever criminal case against a former, current, or former U.S. leader, Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg alleged in a set of facts accompanying the indictment that Trump repeatedly and fraudulently falsified New York business records to conceal criminal conduct that hid damaging information from the voting public during the 2016 presidential election. Peru's northern regions were hit hard by storms and subsequent floods on Monday and Tuesday, leaving streets underwater and causing houses to collapse. Footage taken in the early hours of Tuesday showed impressive thunderstorms occurring in the city of Piura. According to the National Meteorology and Hydrology Service of Peru, the amount of rainfall accumulated during the last days in the city broke all-time records. This is VOA News. An elite Russian security officer who defected says President Vladimir Putin is a war criminal. AP correspondent Charles De La Desma reports.
On October 14, Russian engineer Gleb Karakulov boarded a flight from Kazakhstan to Turkey with his wife and daughter. He switched off his phone to shut out the crescendo of urgent, enraged messages and said goodbye to his life in Russia. But this was no ordinary Russian defector. Karakulov was an officer in President Vladimir Putin's secretive elite personal security service, one of the few Russians to flee and go public who have rank, as well as knowledge of intimate details of Putin's life and potentially classified information. Karakulov says he hopes to inspire other Russians to speak out. Our president has become a war criminal, he says. It is time to end this war and stop being silent. Charles de Ledesma, London.
Witnesses say Israeli police attacked dozens of worshippers in Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque compound before dawn on Wednesday. Israeli police said it was a response to rioting. VOA's Marissa Melton has more.
The Palestinian Red Crescent reported injuries but didn't elaborate on how many people were hurt. It said in a statement that Israeli forces were preventing its medics from reaching the mosque. Israeli police said in a statement that they were forced to enter the compound after masked agitators, to use their phrase, locked themselves inside the mosque with fireworks, sticks, and stones. Violence in the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem has surged over the past year, and there's concern that tensions could escalate this month when the Muslim holy month of Ramadan coincides with Judaism's Passover and Christian Easter. Marissa Melton, VOA News.
A former top aide to a Maryland governor is dead after an FBI manhunt. AP correspondent Jennifer King reports.
Roy McGrath was at one time the chief of staff for former Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. He became the subject of a three-week manhunt when the Florida resident failed to show up for trial in Baltimore on corruption charges on March 13th. Attorneys for his family confirmed that McGrath died Monday after a confrontation with FBI agents in a commercial area on the outskirts of Knoxville, Tennessee. An FBI email said McGrath was wounded during an agent-involved shooting and taken to a hospital. He resigned in 2020, just 11 weeks into his job for Hogan, and pled not guilty to an indictment in 2021. He was accused of lying about the governor's approval for a severance payment of over $230,000 as the head of Maryland's Environmental Service, in addition to allegedly embezzling roughly $170,000 in expenses. Hogan said he and his wife were deeply saddened by this tragic situation. I'm Jennifer King.
For more on this and all the stories we're covering, visit us at voanews.com. We also have an app that you can download. Just search for VOA News. Reporting for VOA News, I'm Richard Green.
Today is Wednesday, April 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, former U.S. President Donald Trump pleads not guilty to 34 felony counts of falsifying business records.
It was just a madhouse. It was a circus outside the courtroom. You had two protests going on simultaneously. One camp was anti-Trump, the other were Trump supporters.
Russia threatens, quote, countermeasures, unquote, against Finland for joining NATO.
Russia said it would strengthen its military capacity in its western and northwestern regions in response to Finland joining NATO. Its defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, also said the move raised the prospect of the conflict in Ukraine escalating further.
And UN officials say female Afghan employees have been banned from working by Taliban authorities. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Former President Donald Trump pleaded not guilty in a historic moment for the United States on Tuesday to 34 felony counts of falsifying business records, as prosecutors accused him of paying two women to suppress their accounts of sexual encounters with him. The indictment unsealed after Trump's court appearance, along with a statement of facts, alleged that Trump and others violated election laws through a scheme to suppress the publication of negative information about him ahead of the 2016 U.S. election. The two women were adult film actress Stormy Daniels and former Playboy model Karen McDougal. The judge said the next hearing for December 4th and did not issue a gag order on any of the parties. For more on the charges, I spoke with Paul Schiff Berman, a Walter X. Cox professor of law at George Washington University.
Well, these are serious charges. They are along the lines of what we expected, but in some ways a little bit more serious because they focus on a multi-incident conspiracy to silence not just Stormy Daniels, but two other people in the last days of the 2016 election. And we have both a financial crime, which Trump is alleged to have covered up these payments, but also an election law crime under federal law, because these payments were illegally made in furtherance of Trump's election and his prospects. So these are serious crimes. They are not as serious as the two other investigations that are proceeding against Trump, both in Georgia and with the special counsel in Washington, D.C.
What stuck out to you during today's event?
I think what stuck out to me most was two additional hush money payments that were allegedly made through the National Enquirer and that were also covered up, which suggests that the prosecutors would like to prove or might be able to prove that this was a pattern and practice of Trump, Michael Cohen, and the publisher of the National Enquirer to silence all potential allegations of sexual misconduct during the last days of the 2016 election.
That's Paul Schiff Berman, a Walter X. Cox professor of law at George Washington University. He was speaking with me from Chevy Chase in Maryland. Hundreds of Donald Trump supporters and anti-Trump supporters on Tuesday swarmed the streets around the courthouse in New York City, where the former president was arraigned on charges related to hush money payments to an adult film actor. Hours before Trump turned himself in, crowds of people whistled, shouted, and raised placards in support of Trump, who has already announced his candidacy for the president in 2024. Separated by barricades from the Trump crowd, counter-protesters celebrated the president's indictment with signs that said, quote, "Lock him up," unquote, a reference to a chant often directed at Trump's opponent Hillary Clinton during his successful presidential campaign in 2016. A large group of reporters watched a scene punctuated by sounds of drums, cowbells, whistles, and horns. One of those reporters is VOA's Trina Trin.
It was just a madhouse. It was a circus outside the courtroom. You had two protests going on simultaneously. One camp was anti-Trump. The other were Trump supporters. And there was just a lot of verbal sparring and people trying to yell over each other. It was a circus, the best way to describe it.
Prior to this, as you call it, circus, there were security beef ups in several locations. Mayor Adams of New York warned about possible unrest. How did the police handle it? Were there any arrests?
As far as I could tell, there were no arrests made today. It was actually, despite the seeming chaos on the surface, security presence was very high, and they were stationed all over the place in the immediate vicinity. And so their presence was made clear. They had erected metal barricades along the sidewalks to redirect pedestrian traffic. Roads were blocked off. And so everybody was really forced to kind of slow down and go through security in order to get close to the action. And even then, you couldn't get that close because it was just so many people between the onlookers, the protesters, the journalists, and the media. And it was just crazy amount of people today who came out.
Some high-profile Republicans also came out to support the former president. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. One of the rallies planned by Republican supporters had scheduled a representative from Georgia, Marjorie Taylor Greene, to come and speak. She did show up, but she did not actually speak because, again, just the crowds made it so hard to get into the surrounding areas. And this particular rally was held in a park directly across from the courthouse. And just because of the security and the crowds of people, I think that prevented her from making it through and being able to get organized in order to speak. But she did show up, but no speaking in terms of talking to supporters there.
With what took place today, the carnival or circus-like atmosphere, depending on who you ask, looks like if this case is going forward to trial, this is going to be almost an everyday affair.
Whether or not this case goes to trial, what follows today's proceedings is going to be a lot of vocal opposition from Trump supporters, a lot of detractors also speaking up. And so there were strong emotions on both sides present today, and that's only going to continue. Remember again that nothing that happens today prevents former U.S. President Donald Trump from running again for re-election. In fact, his campaign team has stated that since the indictment became official, they have managed to raise $5 million from supporters. So it doesn't look like support for him is dying down anytime soon.
That's VOA Trina Trin speaking with me from Manhattan, New York City. The Biden administration says the U.S. will send Ukraine about $500 million in ammunition and equipment and spend more than $2 billion to buy an array of munitions, radar, and other weapons for the country in the future. The latest aid comes as Ukrainian troops prepare for a spring offensive against Russian forces and as NATO foreign ministers discuss how the military alliance can step up its support for Ukraine. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says much of the ammunition will be taken from military stockpiles so it can be in a war zone quickly. Finland formally joined the NATO military alliance on Tuesday in a historic policy shift brought on by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, drawing a threat from Moscow of, quote, countermeasures, unquote. Edward Baran of Reuters reports.
We now declare that Finland is the 31st member of the North Atlantic Treaty.
Finland formally joined the NATO military alliance on Tuesday. The country's foreign minister completed the accession process at NATO headquarters in Brussels. The historic policy shift brought on by Russia's invasion of Ukraine quickly drew a threat from Moscow of, quote, countermeasures. Here's the Finnish defense minister, Antti Kaikkonen.
It is a big day for Finland, of course, and I'd say it's a win-win situation. It's good for NATO also. But our next goal is, of course, to get our good neighbor Sweden to the full membership.
NATO Secretary-General Jens Stoltenberg welcomed Finland to its ranks, noting that Russian President Vladimir Putin had cited opposing NATO expansion as one justification for his invasion.
This will make Finland safer and NATO stronger.
Finland's accession roughly doubles the length of the border that NATO shares with Russia and bolsters its eastern flank as the war in Ukraine grinds on with no resolution in sight. The invasion of Ukraine in February 2022 prompted Finns to seek security under NATO's Collective Defence Pact, which states that an attack on one member is an attack on all. On the streets of Helsinki, a cautious welcome for the news. Russia said on Monday it would strengthen its military capacity in its western and northwestern regions in response to Finland joining NATO. Its defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, also said the move raised the prospect of the conflict in Ukraine escalating further. The Ukrainian government hailed Finland's move, calling it, quote, the right choice. NATO has repeatedly stressed that it is solely a defensive alliance and does not threaten Russia.
That's Edward Baran of Reuters. A new report says at least 401 human rights defenders were killed in 26 countries in 2022, based on statistics from a collective initiative of human rights organizations. Olive Moore is the interim director of the Ireland-based global human rights group Frontline Defenders. She tells VOA's Carol Van Damme these are targeted killings, and it's not just humanitarian aid workers.
It's people who we would not normally perhaps think of when we think of human rights defenders, and local indigenous women living very rurally who are trying to protect the local river that may be polluted by transnational companies, and lawyers who are going to court and standing up for other human rights defenders. Essentially, these are individuals who can be regular individuals like you or me who are stepping up for their communities, who are stepping up for their families, and who are challenging injustice all around the world.
Of the 401 people killed last year, were a sizable number of those human rights defenders in Africa? And if so, can you describe what countries in Africa we're talking about?
Yeah, 20 of those human rights defenders were from countries in Africa. So, I mean, the first country where we saw the highest number of killings in Africa was DRC, where, of course, there's a conflict where we saw 8 defenders who were killed for their work. South Africa, 5 human rights defenders killed, many of them from social movements that were trying to advocate for housing rights, for better conditions for those who were living in slums. And then other countries such as Sudan, for example, also 3 human rights defenders, Kenya, different places. The vast majority of human rights defenders that are killed are from the Americas, but unfortunately, it's a trend that we see all around the world in all continents where human rights defenders are targeted because of their work.
Where in the world is it the most dangerous for these human rights defenders?
Colombia, absolutely, without a doubt, Colombia. And this is something we've seen for many years now. We have tracked 401 human rights defenders all around the world who've been killed. And of those, nearly half of those are in one country, in Colombia.
Why in Colombia?
I think Colombia is a country that has experienced conflict for many decades. We had the peace accords in the last couple of years, but certainly within rural areas and remote areas of Colombia, it's still an extremely dangerous place to be. Where the state doesn't have much of a presence, and where human rights defenders, where communities, where families, where people are caught between paramilitaries and the state.
What would you say? Are things getting better or worse overall with these defenders of human rights?
I think things are getting worse, and this is what human rights defenders are telling us, what they're seeing on the ground. It's really hard to say this empirically, because, of course, we only know, for example, when we say 401 human rights defenders were killed last year, we know this is underreported. There are countries, for example, we can only verify killing a few two human rights defenders in Afghanistan last year, but we know there were many, many more human rights defenders killed.
Back to Africa, I saw in your report that the main types of threats that you're looking at on the continent there is detentions and arrests. Can you just elaborate a little bit on that?
So this is what we see as criminalization. So one of the most effective ways of closing down civil society space and closing down the work of human rights defenders is to target them through the courts, is to threaten them or to target them with arrest, threaten them with detention. And so what it is spurious charges being made against human rights defenders. And increasingly, one of the things we're seeing is the use of counterterrorism. And this is abuse of counterterrorism, where, for example, they will be charged with working against the state. That's one area where we certainly see quite often. Another area would be around perhaps they will be charged with fraud. And again, these are all illegal spurious charges which are made against defenders, which do two things. First of all, it takes all of their time and resources. And of course, if these charges, which often is the case when you run through long court cases and the charges are upheld, defenders are then imprisoned. So this is across the board criminalizing defenders.
That's Olive Moore, interim director of the international rights group Frontline Defenders. She was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Damme from Dublin, Ireland. In other news, UN officials say that female Afghan employees of the United Nations have been banned from working by Taliban authorities. The UN mission expressed, quote, serious concern, unquote, after its female staffers were prevented from reporting to work in the province. Taliban spokesmen were not immediately available to comment, and the group did not issue a statement. The Taliban have imposed harsh measures since seizing power in 2021, as US and NATO forces were pulling out of Afghanistan. Afghan women were barred from working at national and international non-governmental organizations. Women working for the UN were not included in the NGO ban. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu in Washington. As Christians in Iraq prepare to mark Easter Sunday this weekend, the country's Chaldean Catholic Archbishop says religious minorities there deserve a secure future and for their rights to be respected. He made his comments at the start of one of the holiest periods in the Christmas calendar. Dale Gavlak reports from the city of Erbil.
In the Christian enclave of Ankawa in Iraq's northern Kurdish capital of Erbil, the faithful are gearing up for Easter celebrations, following a period of fasting and prayer known as Lent. Over the weekend, many Iraqi Christians turned out for Palm Sunday observances by gathering in churches and streets and waving olive branches, a symbol of the peace they long seek. A Catholic government employee who provided only his first name, Sarmin, described the occasion as a time for Christians to celebrate Jesus, for children especially to recognize their heritage and have hope for the future. Many Iraqis say this is especially important following the persecution of ethnic Yazidis and other religious minorities by the so-called Islamic State group. In 2014, IS rampaged through the Yazidi heartland in northern Iraq. In many cases, they forced young women into sex slavery. Many in the Yazidi community, which numbers more than 500,000, were displaced, and an estimated 5,000 were killed. Meanwhile, the Chaldean Catholic Archbishop of Erbil, Bashar Warda, tells VOA that Iraq's rich mosaic of ethnic and religious minorities, such as the Christians, feels insecure due to a lack of political stability. He notes internal disputes between the central government in Baghdad and the Kurdish regional government in Erbil, as well as interference from Iran.
Our concern as a church is the lack of a secure future, which most of our families still feel because the whole Middle East is unstable yet. The political process after 20 years is still very fragile in Iraq. From time to time you have all of these political crises between Baghdad and Erbil, and that's affect the economy and social life. Gives concern that all of those political parties have not yet really mature enough to lead this nation towards a prosper future.
Archbishop Warder says the rights of all of Iraq's ethnic and religious minorities must be enshrined in the country's constitution. He says action, not just words, must be undertaken by the government to ensure that Iraqis of all backgrounds are recognized and respected.
In a sectarian society like the one that we have, the voice of minority will be always weak. So you need a government program that comes from the voice of majority should really believe, adopt, and do something concrete. It's always a call for reconciliation, a call for national identity, a call. But you need an act, not a call, an act for that.
Before the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003 that toppled dictator Saddam Hussein, Iraqi Christians numbered about 1.5 million. 2 decades later, only an estimated 250,000 remain in the country, analysts say. Sectarian violence and attacks on Christian churches and families in the war's aftermath, as well as the attempted genocide by Islamic State of Iraq's religious minorities, led to large numbers of Christians fleeing Iraq. Del Gavlak for VOA News, Erbil, Iraq.
This is Science in a Minute.
A pair of U.S. scientists have detected repeating radio bursts originating from YZ SETI, a star located about 12 light years from Earth. The detection has led Sebastian Panetta from the University of Colorado Boulder and Jackie Villardson of Bucknell University to find that a rocky Earth-sized exoplanet orbiting close to the radio-transmitting star may have a magnetic field like the one that surrounds and protects our planet. Radio bursts are still mysterious, but some researchers theorize that they are produced by magnetic field interactions between a star and its planets. The researchers used the Carl G. Jansky Very Large Array, a radio telescope operated by the U.S. National Science Foundation's National Radio Astronomy Observatory, to make their findings. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA. Next up, a conversation with Sarah Jacobs, a Democrat from the state of California. Congresswoman Jacobs discusses the Biden administration's revitalized approach to Africa in the aftermath of Vice President Kamala Harris's recent visit to Ghana, Tanzania, and Zambia. A conversation with Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including the unprecedented and historic arraignment of former President Donald Trump. Political analysts say the action has further polarized an already divided nation. Don't miss this discussion and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Chinua Adofo in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On March 23, 2019, the ISIS terrorist group lost the last territories it once held in Iraq and Syria. In the aftermath of ISIS's last stand against the global coalition to defeat ISIS and its local partner, the Syrian Democratic Forces, thousands of fighters were detained, as were tens of thousands of people caught up in the fighting, including families of the fighters. While many of these people are Syrian or Iraqi, thousands more are nationals of third countries or children born in Syria to parents born abroad. They remain in Al-Hol or Raj camps waiting to be repatriated to their home countries. The fighters remain in SDF detention facilities. Some of these foreign populations, particularly the women and children, have been repatriated home. Thousands still live in displacement camps or detention centers in northeastern Syria. We cannot ignore the serious concerns posed by the detainee and displaced person populations in northeast Syria, because those concerns will not ignore us, said Ian Moss, the U.S. Deputy Coordinator for Counterterrorism with responsibility for terrorist detention and countering violent extremism. The home countries of these detainees are often unwilling or slow to repatriate, rehabilitate, reintegrate, and where appropriate, prosecute their citizens. Nonetheless, the pace has picked up in 2022, with over 3,000 foreign nationals repatriated from northeast Syria, equaling the number of the three prior years put together, said Deputy Coordinator Moss. Repatriating these individuals ultimately poses a much lower risk than leaving them in Syria, said Deputy Coordinator Moss. 10,000 ISIS fighters remain in custody, the largest concentration of detained terrorists in the world. And ISIS will look to fill the holes in its ranks by attempting to recruit these detainees. The best way to prevent that is to move them out of Syria. Repatriation, rehabilitation, reintegration, and where appropriate, prosecution and incarceration are the only durable solutions to this problem, said Deputy Coordinator Moss. The United States stands ready to help, not just with the logistics, but also by facilitating the sharing of best practices and expertise, he said. Additionally, our military partners have access to an enormous amount of battlefield evidence from the coalition's counter-ISIS campaign. This can be done, said Deputy Coordinator Moss. Together, we can continue making the type of progress that has already made us safer. But there is more to do, and we cannot let up.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.